Welcome to the Vancouver Institute. Our speaker this evening, Meyer, is uniquely qualified to speak to us on the influence of technology in human affairs. He has a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Illinois, PhD from the University of California in Los Angeles in organic chemistry. But for the past 25 years or so, he has been contributing to our understanding of the social and behavioral sciences with particular application to urban planning. He has held faculty appointments at a number of universities, Chicago, Michigan. In the past, he has been a visitor at Harvard and in Athens. He is presently the professor of environmental design at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of many technical papers and about a dozen books on urban planning, both in North America and in Asia. He's visiting UBC for a period of a week or so as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor, and he will also be giving two lectures at noon hours next week on Tuesday and Thursday. However, we're happy that he has come to the Vancouver Institute first, and I'm happy to welcome him and invite him to address us on the Conserver City, Social Effects of the New Technology. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy, that's what it is, and ladies and gentlemen. You've already been told that I've taken a week off from my own university. Actually, I try to do this about once a year to catch up with what's going on in Canada. So that last year, it was they had an all-Ontario conference in Toronto, and the year before, I spent a week in Calgary. Before that, there were visits mostly to the eastern part of Canada, and all during this period, we have generally several graduate students at any given time from Canada, and they remind us of things that are happening here, so that we're not quite out of touch. The title that was given, I gave a descriptive title, and that they have assigned me the Conserver City, the Social Effects of New Technology, and never before have I spoken under this title. When I invented the subject that I wanted to speak about, I called it the Resource Conserving City. But I'm also noting that the English language changes from, say, India to Canada to Britain to Australia and to the United States, so that the Conserver City probably has certain kinds of meanings here that I have to catch up with before the evening is over. But it had begun, as I said, as resource-conserving cities, and it was the design of resource-conserving cities that I have been interested in now for about 15 years almost. It's worthwhile describing how this happened. Way back in 1960, well, even earlier than that, we had been trying to figure out whether it was possible for the town planners, regional planners, and others to have a chance to put together all that we knew or thought we knew into one place and see if we could make it work. But of course, no society would ever trust us this much, and that therefore it didn't seem ever likely to happen until Venezuela had discovered that its own people were not able to show the government reasonably quickly how to develop a new city in eastern Venezuela. So they came to MIT and Harvard and asked for large-scale help and offered a new city for the planners and social scientists of Harvard and MIT. And they started recruiting people whom they knew from elsewhere. I was teaching at the University of Michigan. So that a number of us thought that we're going to have a really interesting, but even more than that, an absorbing kind of time learning how to put all the pieces together that we were teaching. When I got to eastern Venezuela, I found that almost all the planning was going to be in Caracas because they kept the numbers in Caracas, and that there were no telephones or anything else out on the site. So that the planning was done in Caracas, in major office buildings during the daytime. But one of the things that came out of this is that when one is planning realistically for a country like Venezuela, particularly for the kinds of site that we had huge amounts of hydroelectric power. We had 30-foot depth channels that go all the way to the sea. We had natural gas in abundance. We had petroleum pipelines, connections to that. We had quite good forests upstream that could be used, some bauxite and things of that sort. In other words, virtually any natural resource that you wanted, there it was in abundance. So that the city itself that we were planning, realistically, was one that depended upon resources in abundance. And we ask ourselves, where else in the world will you find this kind of a mix? And the answer was nowhere. So that we were designing a dead end. And the world wouldn't have anything like this anymore, very likely. So that in the evening, I went back to the hotel and started thinking about how I would handle a new city when there were hardly no resources at all that were available. And this would be the resource-conserving city. Eventually, I persuaded the Ford Foundation to give me a travel grant for a sabbatical to actually see where those problems were, which were in Asia almost entirely, although Latin America has serious problems, even more serious problems, larger scale problems exist in Asia. So then at a later date, armed with some of the ideas of how one might theoretically put together a city that could produce enough free time to create an up-to-date modern culture competitive with anything in the West, and yet would have as its base something like 15% or 20% of the resource use per capita of present Western countries, European or American. So that now I began to get from that experience in Asia a feeling for not only where those cities were at the moment, what were the first things that needed to be done, but also the next stage was to figure out how to move into some kind of a long-range strategy. I have to tell you a little bit about the scale of the challenge, because even my colleagues are always bowled over. And then after that, they resist thinking any further because it's outside of the ken of anything that is normally taught in universities. In most of the Asian countries which are still learning family planning, the family planning programs are going reasonably well, we find that the villages are filled to overflowing, that the new children that are born into the villages are likely to have 30 to 50 days of work per year when they grow up, and some of them quite a bit less than that. All the rest of the time, there is no real productive work available. They are, in effect, virtually surplus people. And the only hope that they have in life is to find some kind of place where industrial or service labor is likely to be provided, so that when we talk to the poor people in a place like Jakarta in Indonesia, as I myself don't, I have to look at what the students do. They had a rather interesting exercise in the economics department in the University of Indonesia. They had discovered that a large share of the people came from the business families and the property families of Indonesia, and the families had sent their sons to study economics. So that they had decided that in order to be admitted to the economics department, you had to go out and interview two poor people and bring the interviews to the economics department. And this had some rather bad repercussions because the assistant professor who collected these and made a report out of these hundreds of interviews of poor people, he himself landed in jail. And although I saw him on the last trip to Indonesia, and they just, a few months after he got out of jail, they made him first the head of the department and then the dean. This is a quick way of getting promoted, going to jail for the poor for a little while. But the reports that came from the poor were that one was felt lucky to get one rice meal per day if you were in these overcrowded villages. And that, in other words, it wasn't sure that you were going to get one rice meal per day. And then after that, you had to pick up tidbits here and there to make out. When they were taking the poorest job in the city, even the people who were picking up cigarette butts that would later on be converted into insecticide, they were virtually guaranteed one rice meal per day, and then in addition they were more likely to get the other little snacks to pick up on the side. So that the reports going back to the village would be consistently that you're likely to be able to do better in the city. What this means is that Jakarta will probably have to become three times or four times as big as Tokyo. Tokyo is now around 24 million people in its metropolitan area. So that we have to think of a city of 75 to 100 million people before the family planning sort of catches up and the population comes reasonably close to equilibrium. One of the questions that is often posed by academic city planners, can one ever put that many people together? And there we put a number of students on various kinds of exercises, and we find that it is possible to assemble that many people in one locale. But in order to do so, you have to break all the rules that we presently teach in school in city planning departments in Europe and North America. You cannot do it our way. It's impossible. But it happens that there are technologies and there are ideas that have been tested, many of them in different odd places in the third world, that can, when fitted together, allow one to see that it is possible to assemble people in those large aggregations. Now, when those people get to the city, they come in living rather close to subsistence, this one rice meal per day plus whatever else can be picked up, and that generally means in today's equivalent about $1 per day, one Canadian dollar per day, 85 cents for us, tends to be what it takes you see, I really started out with 85 cents and then I suddenly remembered this. that it was a different 85 cents here. And so that it takes roughly that amount of money to keep one person alive per day with the rent and the food and transport and everything else in one of these third world cities. And that's at the subsistence level. One of the things we noted, though, in talking to poor people, that many of them get ahead in the world. And they work up to $2 a day. And then often they work up to $3 a day, and by that time they're supporting a family of considerable size, and it gets up to four or five. They also rise in status, so that there is a hierarchy. You can work your way up in the world in those cities, and as people work themselves up, they begin to start using the bus. They have to ask themselves, what kind of light are they going to have at night? Will they get a powered kerosene lamp, that is a pressurized kerosene lamp, or will they take in electricity? And one of the things we're discovering in these cities is that now about 40% of those households in the city are electrified. And the other 60% are thinking that maybe it's their turn 5, 10, 15 years hence. When it's electrified, they don't use much power. They normally first get a couple lights, then the next thing will be a television set, if television is very active in their society, if the censorship is not too strict. Radio obviously would be preferred, but many of the radios are on battery. Radio would be first, I should say. Then they would probably get some fans in the tropics, since most of these cities are in the tropics. And after that, it's rather interesting, very little, not even a refrigerator. So that their consumption might be $2, $3, $4 per month in electricity. They will pay, the bus fares will tend to be 5 to 15 cents in these countries. So they'll be paying that, maybe several dollars worth of bus fare. And after that, there's very little use of energy except for cooking. And the cooking is generally done with a single kerosene burner, or it's done with fuel wood, if you can get a hold of fuel wood. And occasionally, if you have a little meat to cook at some time, you may get some charcoal. So that here you have a pattern of consumption that to us seems to be relatively low, but actually can be considered to be quite comfortable, and it does allow people to move up in the area of education. It allows people to self-organize and satisfy their cultural activities in the city. Last spring, we were asked to think through what would be the demands for energy in the third world cities in relation to not so much to supply, but to other kinds of demands. And of course, statistics are never put together this way. We have nothing but national statistics, and most of them can't be believed very much when they come from the third world cities. However, when we made the appropriate corrections and adjustments, we began to see that the growth rate in these cities, allowing for the first the population growth, then later on for the fact that these people make their way up in the city and gradually decide that they can pay the bill for the bus, for the kerosene burner, for the electricity. When that is done, we added up the demand and we found that the third world cities would be somewhere between the year 2000 and 2010, one generation hence, would be consuming as much energy as all the Western world. There are so many people that are coming onto the market in those cities. So that although we had presumed that the Western world would learn how to conserve energy and not really on a per capita basis would not expand, would probably contract, there'd be a few more people in the cities, therefore there'd be a roughly constant, slightly rising demand in the developed world. In the third world, of course, it keeps on marching up the graph paper to the point that it passes the developed world one generation hence and is still going, you see. So the demand there is very strong and will continue for another generation to expand and put the presently developed world in the shadow. Now, when that occurs, we then have to ask ourselves, will there be enough to go around? And if one looks at the supply, he finds that it begins to become a shortage somewhere in the 1990s, particularly in liquid fuels in the world, that there isn't enough to go around between the developed world and the underdeveloped world. And so that the demand begins to become relatively tight, and under those circumstances, the prices are likely to start escalating. The Mexicans have just announced a huge new field that puts them into competition with Saudi Arabia. However, in Houston, where I was 10 days ago, they made an analysis and said that all the Mexican oil at the expected rates of consumption in the 1990s would postpone the time of shortage 3 to 4 years. So that whereas it might have been 1990, 1991 or so when you begin to get the pinch showing, this might postpone it to 1995. So that this puts the Mexican find into perspective as compared to the total world demand. So that when we look at that, we begin to see that with the pinch on, it means that North America is going to have to start cutting back about the time the present new cars are wearing out, or a little bit thereafter. In other words, you may not find it useful to buy a successor to your last new car because it might have to stay in the garage and not be very useful. So that we're getting up to that stage in the closeness between supply and demand. Now, when I start talking about what comes afterward, I've had a great deal of fun sort of pushing two groups of people as to how they were going to adapt to the new future. And one group are the Texans, and the other group are the Albertans. And they're very similar to each other, as you might imagine. They figure that they're so close to the source that the rest of the world will have to pinch first, and that they can continue their lifestyle well into the 21st century. And there was no kind of argument that I could use that would suggest to them that maybe they too might have to give in and adjust to this kind of world that this resource-conserving demand that is being placed upon the world in the future. I really didn't have any leverage until maybe about 8 or 9 months ago, and then some very interesting kinds of reports began to come out, which suggests that the rest of the world is going to have some leverage on the North Americans, and especially the Albertans and the Texans. And it stems from what we call the carbon dioxide accumulation problem. I don't know how much you've seen about it in the newspapers here, so I'll tell a very personal story with respect to carbon dioxide accumulation. As a young boy in the Midwest, the libraries were warm in the wintertime, and the houses may not be, so that I spent a lot of time in the library looking at some of the old books as well as the new books. And some of those old books from the late 1890s were telling about the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from burning all this coal. And they said that sometime in the 20th century that we were going to have very possibly a clouding over effect, and the clouding over effect they called already a greenhouse effect, and that the world might warm up as a consequence. It might also be very sooty, is what they said. Nobody knew for sure whether this was going to happen. It was only a theoretical possibility in the 1890s. And in fact, that theoretical possibility was not really tested out adequately until the year 1960. I remember it very vividly because the American Corps of Engineers wanted to go all out and become the world leaders in regional planning, and they had chosen the Delaware Valley as the place where they were going to show the world. And that they pulled together the city planners, the regional planners, the transportation planners, and all the others that had any responsibility or had been studying any of the theoretical backgrounds, and brought them to Philadelphia and showed them how they were going to manhandle the river and make the river really serve mankind in the Delaware Valley. But they said we had to know where the people were going to live. These dams are going to last more than 100 years, and they demanded of the urban and regional planners, you've got to tell us where the people are going to live. Well, the urban and regional planners are powerless people. If they tell people where to live, people will do something else. So how could they ever forecast where the people were going to live in the Delaware Valley 100 years hence? So we spent a whole day trying to tell those engineers that we couldn't help them, that nobody knew where those people were going to live. And the engineers at the end of the day got up and insisted that we're going to build those dams, but we got to know how high to build them and exactly where to build them. And you've got to tell us where those people are going to live. The next morning, I happened to notice before the session began that on the top floor of the same hotel, the catalytic chemists were meeting, the International Union of Catalytic Chemists. In one of my former lives, I was a catalytic chemist myself. And I had written a master's degree in a master's thesis in the area, actually. So I said, well, rather than face those engineers, let's see what the catalytic chemists are doing these days. I went up to the top there, and the first thing I saw was the infrared spectrum of carbon dioxide. And I looked at it closely, and I said, why, sure enough, there it is, way off in the infrared, just in the part of the spectrum where the Earth sends out its radiation to outer space to keep it at equilibrium. See, we're getting all this energy from the sun in the visible part of the spectrum, and then the Earth sort of works it over, and it sends it out to outer space in the infrared. But the carbon dioxide actually absorbs some of the infrared, and then with a little hesitation, it either sends it out to outer space, but some of it is sent back to Earth. And therefore, it could, if carbon dioxide accumulated in the atmosphere, it could warm the surface of the Earth. So that I could come down to those engineers and say an hour later that we didn't think that the planners really should provide those data, because the engineers 100 years from then would not even know which way the water was running over their dams. Because if that warming effect had occurred, then the ice of northern Canada, of Greenland, and of Antarctica would be melting, and we could calculate that there's enough ice above sea level that at equilibrium it would be around 350 to 400 feet extra sea level all around the Earth. Now, you wouldn't yet, in 100 years, get all of it melted, but it would be enough for their lower dams to have the water running the wrong way. And so, the engineers retreated to Washington. Since that time, for a while, more elaborate theoretical analyses had indicated that although the carbon dioxide was there, it probably was going to be absorbed in the Pacific Ocean. See, as it's produced from our automobiles and from our factories and from our houses and everything else, it blows around the Earth and then goes past Europe, over Russia, comes around over the Pacific Ocean, and the Pacific Ocean starts absorbing it. Photosynthesis goes on in the Pacific Ocean, and it comes back to the west coast of North America, relatively cleaned up, you see. And so then the air can start being charged up with carbon dioxide again and will be cleaned up in the Pacific. However, the people had to make a number of assumptions about how fast and how much contact those air masses would have with the Pacific. And therefore, in these assumptions, they started raising numbers of questions about things that had to be measured. Then eventually, the questions became so serious, they had conferences last year. And last year, in Woods Hole and other places, they began to realize that the evidence was coming from the mountain Mauna Loa in Hawaii, where they had the instruments sort of picking up that air and analyzing how much carbon dioxide there was after it had gone across the Pacific, and that they found that each year it was rising higher, and that it looked as if the Pacific Ocean wasn't big enough to take care of the fossil fuel that was being burned on Earth, and therefore it was starting to accumulate in an escalating fashion. The general projection into the future would be that if the Earth started warming a little bit, then the carbon dioxide, the whole Pacific Ocean would get warmer, and then more carbon dioxide would bubble out of the Pacific Ocean, and that would accelerate it even faster, so that once it started warming, it would start warming quite fast because of the extra effects, catalytic effects. They're not quite catalysis, but acceleration type effects on the Pacific Ocean. So that there was something here to be really worried about, and they had to put together some computer models of the whole global atmosphere and try to figure out what is going on. Now, each international meeting that I've been attending this year They've put on emergency meetings, generally in the evening when everybody's there so that they can catch their attention. Somebody's crossed off the program who's, let us say, whom they can afford to insult, and they can then put in the man who's bringing in the latest data from the group that is looking at the carbon dioxide problem for the world. The man they could afford to insult in Jerusalem was a Japanese futurist, and they thought they had more on the future than the Japanese could provide, and so that from Oak Ridge provided the report. And his report began to suggest something unexpected, and that is that the maximum impact of the carbon dioxide problem would be on Canada, of all places in the world, and that they showed isotherms of the warming up effect, 2.5 degrees or so, actually at that time they thought it was 2 degrees, 2 degrees all over the world in perhaps two generations. Remember, I was talking before of these large cities coming up in 1 to 2 generations, so that we're dealing here with the same kind of time frame, 1 to 2 generations, and that at that time, the increase in temperature in the tropics would be only about 1 degree or so, but in the northern part of Canada, it was thought to be 5, 6, or 7 degrees centigrade. And that, therefore, the melting effect would be focused on northern Canada. The climatic changes would be focused on Canada. So that if this model was correct, and they still were unsure because it was the first one they'd put together that had regional components in a climatic model, if the model was correct, then it would focus much more on Canada than in any other part of the world. This then means that the people in Alberta, it's relatively close to home, and that there is some reason for North Americans to start conserving fuel. Now, in between, the argument was raised that maybe it isn't all due to the combustion of fossil fuels. There's another big change occurring in the world, and that is the cutting down of the tropical forest. And one Brazilian had made some calculations which indicated that perhaps half of this carbon dioxide might be coming from the tropical forest. However, at the last meeting, 10 days ago or so in Houston, with the last report, indicated that the temperature rise would be a little bit more than had previously been estimated, and that the contribution from the tropical forest was somewhat less. Instead of half or 40%, it was more like 20%. So that each time we're beginning to see somewhat better figures being put together. Now this will keep on going on for the next 10 years as they improve the forecasting devices that we have for global climatology. And then sometime a little before 10 years, some recommendations have to be made. And the recommendations, if the models keep on saying what they're saying now, would suggest that we have to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels to perhaps 1/3 of what we are now consuming. And 1/3 is a very large cut. So now I have to describe what North America can do if the carbon dioxide accumulation problem forces us to, in fact, make a contribution to the reduction of the use of fossil fuels. Now, when I do this, I have to start thinking about the major sources of use of fossil fuels. Now, in Canada, it tends to be very heavily domestic, but for North America as a whole, it is really automobiles, vehicles, that are the major single use. About 35%, really, when one takes all the secondary features into account. So that we ask ourselves, what kind of society could you have 1 to 2 generations hence in North America, an urban society? that is conserving, and is conserving not just because there's a shortage of fuel altogether, but because burning too much fuel begins to change the total environment. Well, the biggest demand in North America is for personal transportation, which we call automobiles, but it might be pickup trucks, and sometimes it's motorcycles and things of that sort. What kind of personal transportation will give us almost as much freedom and nevertheless would cost, say, one-fifth or so as much fuel or even less? Bicycles come to mind. The fuel that they use is food. It isn't energy-free, but nevertheless, bicycles are a possibility. Slightly motorized bicycles, called mopeds, up to 2 horsepower, turn out, when we make the calculations, to be more economical than walking after the first mile. And that small electric cars and others, for those that are in climates or those of an age that can't quite handle the two-wheel moped. But there are three-wheelers, in addition, that are being developed in other parts of the world that we never see around here, hardly ever see. And the real competition in, to try to discover which is going to be the effective three-wheeler is going on in Jakarta, where there are about 4 different varieties, quite different engineered, each one catering to a somewhat different kind of population, most of them serving as taxi cabs or jitneys and in the city, and that they can actually move people around in covered kinds of vehicles at a cost that is, in energy terms, 1/5, 1/8, or some small fraction of an automobile. Another, the electric cars, of course, depend upon some kind of fuel, hydroelectric or nuclear, that doesn't require fossil fuels. For public use, the buses, the diesel buses, etc., still provide an awful lot of rides for a small amount of carbon dioxide emanation or a small amount of calories, so that the bus is an efficient way of movement. And another way of making use of the bus that Canada has been pioneering in is the dial-a-ride, the combination of computers, telecommunications, and the bus, or the minibus or the bus, perhaps combined with a taxi cab. That the dial-a-ride approach may be something for the future, where you normally telephone and say that in 20 minutes you'd like a ride to somewhere, and you expect something to come up to the door and let out a musical horn, and then you go out and get on with other people. In the case of freight, what we'd have to do is to find ways of living without so much mass. This building would be out. And it takes too much freight. And of course, there's energy in making the cement in addition. Instead of using trucks, we'd try to move to barges as much as possible and to slower speed boats. We'd very possibly have to ration airplane tickets, because this is one place where there seems to be a boom and a continuing boom in the use of fossil fuels. How to ration airplane tickets, I've never been able to figure out, because most of the very smart people try to ride airplanes, and they'll outwit the bureaucracy at every stage. So that this will be a no-win type of game. One other method of transportation should be mentioned, and that is to stay at home and still do your work. So that the Stanford Research Institute has been trying to figure out whether you can use a wire, or in fact telecommunications channel, which might be microwave, doesn't use hardly any energy at all, but it will convey the messages to some place at the corner where you can tie into the computer, you can tie into the word processing machines and that sort of thing. They have found that in the San Francisco Bay Area, it is already becoming economic to decentralize the insurance industry, and there's something like 50 to 80,000 jobs in the central part of the city in insurance. So that these can be made, put close to home, so that you could get on your bicycle and go over to some little storefront that provides you with access to the company's computers and with the mail service and other things, that you can get your work done. One day a week, you might have to get on an airplane or go into the central city or do something that's not associated being at home. This is not true, however, with banking. We normally think of insurance and banking as being very similar kinds of occupations, but it turns out that insurance people put their trust in paper, and the bankers have to trust each other. And that means they want to look the other guy in the eye, and that means they have to be down in the central part of the city. All right, so the vehicles is one. Another kind that should be considered is in the domestic dwellings, where solar is obviously a possibility in the southern part of the United States and in certain parts of the north also, where we have sunny winters. But in Canada, there's much less chance of that. However, there was a conference last spring which really did describe a solution for Canadians and also for Californians in very different ways. And this came out with studies that have actually been finished in Canada to build the houses underground. Not so much here in Vancouver, but as you get to the other side of the mountains, all the way to the East Coast, one can save 90% or so of all of the air conditioning or heating costs of the homes if you put 1 to 3 meters of earth over the roof. And it could be demonstrated that the life cycle cost, that is, when you take into account the costs over the whole life cycle of the structure, including the savings, that it is already economic to build in this fashion. So that you'd put a few openings south facing on your house, put 1 to 3 meters, depending upon the kind of climate you have, of dirt over it. It's sealed. If you want to have daylight, you can put a special kind of a chimney up where at the top of the chimney, it's something like planetarium or astronomical observatory, where the top of the chimney sort of follows the sun around and reflects it down into the interior of the house. So you can have a daylit house, even if it's 3 meters underground. And you can, in fact, even put pictures in it if you wish and flash the pictures on the wall. Have your own scenery underground. So that all these things are reasonably economic. It's just that people don't like to live in holes. So we've been asking, what would persuade people to live in holes? And it appears that energy conservation is not one of those things. However, we're discovering that now in Kansas, in certain parts of Nebraska and Texas, people are asking how to build these homes themselves because there's so many headlines in the newspaper about tornadoes and hurricanes, and they've discovered that neither a tornado nor a hurricane blows an underground home down. The people have decided that the next time, some of them, not all of them, still a minor fraction, but it is the University Extension Divisions find it's the hottest short course that they can give out in the cow counties. There is a fair amount of enthusiasm. In California, we're having trouble with brush fires. So that we notice that those people who built their houses underground, the fire goes right over the top and they can move back in the next day. Whereas the others have to go to the insurance company and see what they can get back. The architects are being asked, maybe we should burrow into the hillside and have an underground house instead. All the various methods of conservation that we've been working out suggest that by insulation and things that the government requires, you might save 30% of the energy. By playing a game against the weather and really being sophisticated about it, you can save maybe 50-60% with good quality houses, well managed and everything else. But by going underground, you can save 90%. So 90% would be the sort of thing for the 21st century. There are other ways too. Take some of the existing houses. I had a student about 9 years ago or so who'd already done everything, but he hadn't gotten his degree. And they said, the architect said, well, we can't teach you anything. You'll have to go study with Meyer because he's not an architect. And he came to me and he said he needed two more courses to graduate. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he says, I want to design the kind of house for the 21st century that people ought to live in. And I said, that's great. I'm interested in that too. And I asked him, how are you going to do it? He says, oh, I'm going to build it. I'm going to live in it. And I said, well, I can't really judge something like that. So if you're going to live in it, I'll bring my son, and you know, who's in high school, and a girlfriend, and they're going to live in that period. And that if they say it's all right, well, then you get a grade, you see. So at the end of the term, he said it's all ready, and he invited us in, and they looked in the door, and they said, wow, you got an A. but what did they see? They saw no furniture. They saw a padded room. The floor was padded. The walls were padded. It was insulation. It was ventilated by fans. It was all set up for living in a communications age so that he could put on videotapes, films, anything in the room. He had obviously the ultra hi-fi set, that kind of thing. There was a bunk bed in the back. There was only about 160 square feet, and he and his girlfriend, who was composing computer music, so this was really a 21st century type couple, were living in this house in that amount of space. They had a small galley set off for cooking. The galley had to take the camera as well, that is the not the camera, the any of the equipment for putting on films or videotapes. And so that if ever you wanted to sit down on the floor, well, you sort of kicked around the floor a little bit and you fitted up a place to sit on that fit, well, your sitting apparatus, and you could lean against the wall if you would, or you could build it up a little higher. It was made out of crushed polyurethane foam, and that's one of the reasons he didn't need any furniture. It was very easy to clean. It only took something like 10-15 minutes to clean the whole interior of the house. It was virtually dust-free. They could have a party in this small place of 13 people and not have anybody step on anyone else, this was a standard student-sized party. Now, he'd also designed it in such a way that it could be fitted into any standard apartment and would cost no more money than you'd normally expend for living room and dining room furniture, say at that time about $3,000. And therefore, you would build this kind of a unit and then leave the rest of the apartment as a kind of an indoor patio or something, or leave it something like we used to have parlors in old-fashioned houses that were only heated when the preacher came. They're otherwise left cold, or at least at whatever was the outside temperature. I said, it looks like it fits, but you still have one more course. What are you going to do? I said, well, looks to me what you have to do is to think through what all the competition, whenever this becomes a fad, what all the competition is going to invent to rip you off, and therefore any of your patents would never net you any results, and you have to then think of something better than any of the future competition could ever think of. And you've got to do it in 10 weeks. And he did. So that he then indicated it was possible to take spaces like this and introduce, with the aid of his computer-minded girlfriend, the mood control devices, particularly based upon color. And he could introduce color into this unit. He could also set up special meditation devices. He thought originally he'd need a Japanese garden about 1 meter square to meditate on, but he discovered that if he let it grow up in weeds, he had a natural ecosystem, and it was much more fun meditating on a natural ecosystem than a well-managed Japanese garden. Here was one solution. in the western part of the United States, we suspect that there's likely to be an Asian solution also, where one can find the Japanese bath or the Korean bath and other kinds of community arrangements that people really don't need very much living space to themselves, and that they would have some community space. They don't have to have a refrigerator of their own. They have a community refrigerator. And when you fit all these things together, you can actually have a highly civilized kind of life without the expenditure of very much energy. The main difficulty is that people don't know how to do it. Therefore, we probably have to start thinking through ways of selling this. Now, at the moment, in the San Francisco Bay Area, there is a futurist by the name of Willis Harmon who goes around arguing with people that they've got to learn a new technique in living, which he calls voluntary simplicity. That the parents have to start figuring out ways of teaching their kids how to choose voluntarily how to live simply. He's not having much success. And with the parents, more with the kids perhaps, but even the kids find it rather difficult. So, what we're beginning to see is that we need some gurus, some preachers, some belief systems, some organizers in that sense that one becomes committed to, and that the lifestyle comes along as part of it. That might be one direction to go. However, there's another direction that is very common to America, and that is people like to go out camping in national parks. They really have invented a lot of new lifestyles in America since World War II. And that what we should do, very likely, is to have a promoter advertise maybe about 10 different lifestyles that he can develop in apartment houses or in tract areas, community style, so that people can learn how to live Japanese in a resource-conserving fashion, and that they would then learn the Japanese cooking, the Japanese baths, and all of the folderol, how to sit on tatami mats, and how to be comfortable with a fan, and goes on and on in this fashion. And with this instruction, then people can decide after 3 months, do I like it or don't I? And if they didn't like it, they could go on and try, let us say, an Arab style, or I could find about 8 or 10 resource-conserving lifestyles in the world that were likely to be importable to the western part of the United States. So if you had one of them, we might call Studio, which is very similar to what my student had invented in Berkeley and had lived in. I guess my conclusion then from about not only the energy scarcities that appear to be coming, say, around 1995, but also about the burgeoning urban population in the rest of the world, and about potential issues that will arise if carbon dioxide continues to look the way it does now, that three generations from now, we will have been forced to change, and we will look back upon this particular era as an era of popular addiction to mobility and to technocratic solutions, because virtually all of the solutions that I foresee are very strongly behavioral solutions. They're ways of learning how to live in a different fashion in solving problems by getting together with other people. And the economizing is done through cooperation and collaboration. And it also looks as if that the pacemakers in this kind of adaptation, when we look back at it from the future to the present or to the near future from now, it looks as if the North Americans, and perhaps particularly the Canadians, are going to have to be the pacemakers, because they're right in the center of things. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer has agreed to answer some questions. I would remind you of our conventions, one short question per person. I would ask Dr. Meyer to repeat the question so that we're sure that everybody has heard it. We're open for questions. There's one right here.
Yes.
One of the advantages of your underground city, yeah, of course, is underground living, is evasion of nuclear attack and sort of carpet bombing. But wouldn't you be very vulnerable to floods?
Only if you build in the floodplain. There are some stupid people left, but I would say the nuclear issue is not as safe as you think, because one of the real worries we have about tight houses that are energy conserving is that the Americans, in this case the Washington Americans from Washington, D.C., have set up standards for air pollution that are so strict that for the out of doors, that now that they're collecting them for indoors, and if they put the same alarms they put on for Los Angeles or Denver, other things, we might have 30-40% of the houses in America going on three alarm, red alarms, that sort of thing, due to indoor pollution. Now, underground, we tend to have less circulation of air, fewer leaks in the houses. Therefore, there's a tendency for the number to be higher unless one instruments the house or, in fact, takes particular care. One of the features that they suggest will also be the case for underground houses is that underground, you'll tend to have the continuous release of radiation, which is more severe than you're likely to get from at least small-scale nuclear weapons, just due to the normal uranium in the rocks, and that we would get it from this building too, from the aggregate that's in this concrete. It just happens that the levels that we have set for radiation and for air pollution are probably too strict by a factor of 10, maybe even 30, but unfortunately they're written into law and they're being imitated all over the world. So that we're going to have a huge amount of confusion and conflict between toxins and radiation in the environment and energy conservation during this next 10 to 15 years. So you raised a very significant question, but it took us off in a different direction than you had anticipated. Way back there.
How would you view Dr. Lovin's estimate that with the technical fix alone, we could reduce our energy consumption to about one quarter of its present level in about 50 years?
Amory Lovins, perhaps many of you don't know who he is. He's a young, trained as a scientist. Now he could be called a generalist. He had published a book called Soft Energy Paths. Did I get it correct? And he had decided that one of the best places to test these ideas was in California. And so that we've had a year and a half of study now on testing Amory Lovin's ideas as to how to use wood and organic materials to a large extent, hydroelectric power, geothermal, but on the other side, use extensive conservation. One of the things that we're discovering is that his specific numbers, his specific formula, is one that does not work for California in the sense that it can't provide any economical supply of liquid fuels, and that we have the whole state built in such a way that it requires a lot of mobility. We'd have to abandon about half the state in order for us to operate it according to Amory Lovin's requirements. Perhaps we will have to abandon about half the structures in the state in the long run, but people are reluctant to admit it. And we're actually looking at the Pacific Ocean as a possibility. Can we make biogas from the Pacific Ocean to make up the difference after the fossil fuels are gone? The difficulty is that salt water, so far, slows down this biogas process so much that it makes it highly uneconomic. So nobody's found a way yet of finding the right enzymes and speeding up those organisms. The other way we're thinking of is against the law, and that is to use the coastline for growing algae synthetically and converting them into food, and the lowest grade algae would be converted into liquid fuels eventually through biogas. So that right now, after we've discovered that his approach yields certain major deficits, then we're trying to see if we can't add to the supplies for the specific kinds of fuels that were needed for the western part of the United States. When I say it's illegal to grow algae, for instance, we have a Bay Conservation and Development, Bay Conservation, BCDC we call it, and I have really forgotten what it stands for, and that it has stopped virtually all development in the Bay, that we could have several hundred square miles of ponds, protected freshwater ponds floating on the salt water, but it just happens to be against the law, against all the zoning requirements and everything else, and it would be battled to the end by at least the present generation of conservationists. So although Amory Lovins is friends of the earth and a strong conservationist, his program, if we wanted to follow it, the logic through to the end, would be stopped by the conservationists. So we're running into those kinds of conflicts. Over there, yes. Where a large share of the publicity begins. So when the budget for hydrogen fusion is in jeopardy, you begin to hear a lot of optimistic noises coming from Berkeley, from Livermore, from Princeton, and places like that. Therefore, the last big announcement from Princeton, really, which they brought in the reporters, the New York Times had on the front page and everything else, really was something that we'd sort of taken for granted about 2 to 3 years ago in looking at the prospects, and that they just said, yes, indeed, it's true. And so that when one looks at it, the fusion industry is quite a long way off, well into the 21st century, like 2120 or beyond. If fusion does come in, it will not solve the liquid fuels problem for transportation, because the reactors appear likely now, although the technology could change again in the future, appear likely to be much larger than the present fission reactors. In fact, they're likely to have fission reactors and fusion together, and they might be 5 times the scale, so that fusion would normally, we imagine, be for these very large cities and would take care of the electric power needs of very large cities, if it comes. The betting is still much less than 50-50. Anybody who wants to put his money on it, much less than 50-50, that it would ever come. Now, there was a question down here next.
Yes, just a comment at one point. On the Pacific coast, we have a great source of methanol and ethanol from wood waste, yes. Which is a renewable liquid fuel, which would fit in.
Yes.
What I was really wanting to have you comment on why you avoid stressing the corporate structure for its huge buildings, it's a production of automobiles that only last 10 years, and the huge expenditure on conventional and nuclear weapons. All of these things absorb tremendous quantities of energy.
You put your finger on some of the biggest elements. Now, the office buildings and that sort of thing, there are solutions that we could see similar to the others. A good example is what's happening in our own architecture building. The physicists have come down from the hill, and they're collaborating with the architects, and that they're saying, let's redesign the window, and let's use the window for daylighting, even the deep parts of the building. And so that I got an announcement yesterday that they could get a good quality daylighting 60 feet away from the window for whenever the sun was up, you might say, so that for the Berkeley area, that would be, even in the wintertime, it's likely to be 6 hours per day, and most of the office day. That at the same time, they're designing fluorescent lamps, such as those above, so that they don't have the normal ballast, but they have a small computer there. And the computer will sense the amount of light there is on the working surface, and then we'll gradually turn on the fluorescent lights so that you have only enough light to standardize the quality of light at the working surfaces. This way, they can reduce by two-thirds or so one of the major energy requirements that go into office buildings. The other kind of big energy demand happens to be because they put glass fronts on the buildings, and that this has to go, so that as soon as the price of energy went up three times, I got a call from my chairman. One half of me belongs to the architecture department at Berkeley, and he says, you've got to teach a different course. Our architects can't design the way they used to have a heating plant and a cooling plant fight each other, and the equilibrium was supposed to come out at comfort and in the office buildings. And that the now they have to start going back and understanding ventilation right from the bottom up and how to provide for comfort in a fundamental fashion. And that, therefore, we now begin to see the redesign of new office buildings. They haven't yet occurred. This is only 4 years afterward. I would say that they will begin to occur about 5 years, 6 years hence. You've got some of the beginnings right here on campus with the underground library. They have another one in Minneapolis. There's an underground school just outside of Washington, D.C., an underground library in Fort Worth. And libraries come very close to being the equivalent of office buildings. In each instance, they're finding huge savings, again, in the operation of these buildings. So that I guess we're a little less worried, partly because office buildings are quite a bit more adaptable. They're replaced more frequently than the dwellings themselves. They're also replaced more frequently than schools. And many times you're going to get some of the best design work being done on them, so that we're likely to see some innovations coming quite rapidly in the buildings. As to the military, I was once one of the atomic scientists, so that I've been anti-military. I was their representative in Washington. One can only say is that we're working very hard on it, so that the SALT negotiations are being reported in detail every month in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, that we're now starting to talk about what comes after SALT 2, in SALT 3, et cetera. When are we going to get to actual disarmament? And it appears that when this generation is out of control, both in the United States and the Soviet Union, there may be some kind of a turnaround, because the Soviet Union can't afford to expend that energy either, and just as we will not be able to afford it very soon. So the pressures within the society themselves show that something has to give, perhaps within 5 years, so that the peak will have been reached and we start going down the other side in terms of disarmament. Now, way back there. Is there a what? An optimum for least energy per capita. There can't be, because of the demands of the environment. So that we start out with how much is necessary for feeding people, and we start out then with over 2,000 calories, say 24 or 2,500 calories. We have to ask then how much energy it takes to produce that food alone. That gets us up to maybe 4,000 to 5,000 calories, even if it's organized Chinese style, that is with very little fossil fuel input. And it may get up to 6,000 if you try to make an efficient city. The cities that I was talking about in the future in Asia, to a large extent, would be producing a large share of their own food, certainly the tonnage of food, within the city itself. That's one that makes it very different from the Western city today. And it's only the dry food, the sugars, the grains, the pulses, the cooking oils, that are likely to be imported from the countryside. So that one begins to see the human waste of the city coming back to the city and recycled in this fashion, with vegetables and everything else growing. You begin to see that the human demands there are, in fact, the human waste become part of the input again for the new demands, and that the old method of calculation of looking at how many calories are required per human, as soon as you start thinking of a city as an urban ecosystem, then we need perhaps 3,000 or so extra calories for the human being instead of, say, 5,000 or 6,000. Then transport and a few other things add a few more thousands, so that under tropical conditions, it looks as if an adequate level of living, competitive with the West, might be done with 8,000 to 10,000 calories for manufacturing and all the other things tied together. And that's, say, three generations hence when there's no fossil fuel left. Now that's about 1/10 of what it would be in the average in more northern countries in Europe and North America. That it gives you some numbers, anyhow. Yes. Way back there. Oh, see, the question, if I get it straight, is would it be easier for a socialist society to create a conserving society than a capitalist society? Is that proper? No.
That's not the question.
Okay, well then you restate it.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah.
Would you comment on the apparent contradiction between commitment to capitalism or, in other words, commitment to growth and consumption and the establishment of a conservative society?
Well, you're arguing that commitment to capitalism is the only way in which growth occurs in the world, when actually the socialists' claim to date has always been that they could grow faster than capitalism. So that this problem of growth is a very severe issue. An interesting feature that comes out, though, if we can concentrate on telecommunications as a means of conquering distance, and as a means of controlling, as a means of conserving, of watching things when humans are not watching, then we can begin to see an approach whereby one can level off over time and still have not any increase in the demand for energy or even a decrease. Let me put this on the board. The first thing that is required, of course, is that the population of the Earth come to some kind of an equilibrium. And actually, many of the family planning programs in the third world are starting to go rather well. Some of them have barely begun, but many are going well. So that there's actually had to be a reduction in the estimate of the world's population at the year 2000 because of this improvement in performance greater than expected. So that we have to anticipate now that the world population might level off at, say, 9 to 11 billions. And at one time, only a few years ago, when I put this estimate down, it was 10 to 12 billions. Right now, it's about 4.3. Now, the energy requirements, since so many of these 4.3 and a good many of those to be born have no... I have to break the chalk. Energy has been going up like this, and somehow or other we have to bring it off, to level off, and that the energy here, to a large extent, is based upon solar, is based upon wood, geothermal, hydroelectric, things of this sort, rather than fossil fuels. It might include a fair amount of nuclear. So that now the question is, how does one build a system whereby here we have been always trying to maximize economic growth rates, but now we have to find some kind of a steady state, and economic theory doesn't tell us very much, hardly anything at all, about approaching the steady state. In this instance, I've been arguing, and I brought with me an argument, a working paper from my university, in which I argue that the new body of theories, this is normally called nowadays a new paradigm for planning will have to deal with this leveling off, which is really an ecological principle, And therefore, the new paradigm for planning will be community ecology. And I then try to indicate some of the special tasks that ecological theory can contribute that go beyond those of economic theory. I'm having a lot of fun arguing this out with my students.
I think we have time for about one more question.
All right, over there.
I'd like to come back to the massiveness of buildings and structures.
Sure.
You said that buildings like this would be out as an illustration. Uh-huh. How can this be reconciled with the with your prediction that cities will be very dense, 50, 70 million? I'm not convinced.
Yeah. I didn't say dense. They're spread out, but they'd be large in scale, urban regions, yes.
The question really is, if we do have such dense cities, especially if they go underground, how can you avoid that density, material density of the structure?
Well, actually, one of the things that one can do immediately is to throw away the furniture. And all the room above the beds, above the big divans and the big tables and everything else, and we sat on the floor, and we can actually have as much action space in the house with 100 to 150 square feet per capita as we now have in California when we build at 500 square feet per capita in a house. That's the average now in California. It probably is for Vancouver. So that we can save one third of the floor space and about, say, 60% of the mass in a building if we just get away from our old-fashioned habits. Now, one can keep on going in this direction and start asking about what are some of the most efficient materials for construction, and then one can save quite a bit more. So that if one does just a few reasonable things, he can reduce the amount of mass that's normally associated with living and with working at least two-thirds. And it will be just as comfortable as now.
I like my grandfather's tables and chairs.
Put them in the basement.
I'd like to call on Dr. Terry McGee, who's the director of UBC's Institute for Asian Research, to thank our speaker.
Thank you very much. I first met Richard Meyer, I think it was in 1971 or 72 in Hong Kong, when he and I were both studying some aspects of the poor of Hong Kong. He was looking at intermediate transport systems, in this case, and often eat very good Chinese meals. And during that time, we had long and very protracted discussions about the kind of problems which he raised tonight. Often at the end of those meals, I used to go home with my mind whirring with a mass of ideas which he released during those discussions. And I must say that I feel a little like that at this moment, and I'm sure you do too. However, I think there are at least two themes that do emerge from what he's told us, or perhaps three. The first is that, you know, the people who've told us that we are living on spaceship Earth are right. The interrelationships of the world, which he's drawn out in such a, to me, very stimulating manner, are only too obvious. What is happening to the people in the cities of Asia has its implications for the people of Canada. We can't always see those implications so clearly, but it's very clear when you hear such a discussion as you've heard tonight that our future is intimately linked with the future of those people in that region and other regions of the underdeveloped world. I think the second thing that strikes me, as it's always struck me with Dick Meyer's work, is the way he makes us look forward. He continually throws out ideas about the future of the world, the kind of world we may be living in 2000 AD. And it's very necessary for us to think about these questions. Too often we get involved in the immediacy of solving this particular problem at this particular time. We need the futurologists. They make us think. We don't have to believe them all the time, but it's very necessary for them to launch their ideas into the world community of ideas. I think the third point is, the third thing is that Dick Meyer throws out challenges to our conventional forms of life, our lifestyles. And he brings into that an understanding of technological demands, energy demands, which the kind of lifestyles we lead at the moment make or lead us to participate in. I really feel that I should perhaps sit down on the floor at this moment and thank Dick, but I am not quite sure I will do that, because I am too a product of my lifestyle. In conclusion, then, I'd like to thank you very much for your really stimulating talk and your usual surge of ideas. Thank you.
There are just two brief announcements. Next week, the final talk for the autumn season, Dr. Margaret Ormsby on New Perspectives on BC History. And I have a free offer. The person who sells memberships at the door isn't here this evening, but I am authorized to tell you that if you want to join, and you should, there are coupons on these autumn programs, and if you fill it out and send your membership fee to the address that's given there, then you will hear about the spring program, whether or not the newspapers publish. So pick up a coupon, come along.